Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Tom Cliff, a Discovery Early Career Research Fellow at the Australian National University, about his book Oil and Water, Being Han in Xinjiang, which was published in 2016 by University of Chicago Press. Now, Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region is a part of the modern People's Republic of China with a very storied history and a profoundly troubled present, one that thankfully is now attracting greater attention from concerned parties around the world. But Tom Cliff's Oil and Water, Being Han in Xinjiang, shows us an aspect of this region that has been little explored in depth, namely the lives of the local Han Chinese population there. Based on many years of residence in Kola, a major town in southern Xinjiang, and a production centre for the region's oil industry, Cliff draws us close to the thoughts, dreams, beliefs, aspirations, and legends of his interlocutors, answering in rich ethnographic detail a question he says he's been posing himself since 2001, namely, what is it like to be a Han person living in Xinjiang? Given the fullness of his perspective and the diversity of his subjects, the answers Cliff offers are inevitably multiple, varied, and shifting. Indeed, in offering us this kind of anthropology of experience of Han settlers from the past seven or so decades of settlement, Cliff deliberately avoids full closure on certain subjects, and particularly through very compelling use of photographs, and they really are beautiful images, very striking images, I should say, allows readers scope for interpreting many of the frontier situations he discusses. However, despite portraying this rich picture of everyday life there, he doesn't shirk some pretty forceful and hard-hitting conclusions about situations and a broader regional situation, which without doubt is often dark and devastating in its effects, particularly when it comes to imagining any alternative vision for Xinjiang to one completely subsumed by centre-bound settler colonialism. By showing us the very human ways in which China's Xinjiang frontier operates on an individual and local level, Cliff makes an inestimable contribution to what should for all of us be a region of increasingly pressing concern. But to discuss this and the book as a whole, I'll now say Tom Cliff, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Ed. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you here, and I enjoyed reading the book. It's a tremendously rich and fascinating portrayal of a side of life, which, as I say, is not widely covered in the region. But perhaps I could begin by asking you something about yourself and your academic background, your personal background, how it was that you came to focus on China and Xinjiang, about your formation as a both an academic and, I suppose, an ecological being.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I sort of began life as a photographer. So I was traveling through Southeast Asia in the early 90s, and somebody who I met said to me, you have to go to China. You can't ignore China if you're a social documentary photographer. And so I went there, even though I didn't really want to. I thought that, you know, there's way too many Chinese people, and I don't speak the language anyway, and, you know, Chinese people don't like other outsiders. You know, this is my image of China before I went there. And then I got to Hong Kong, and I was tired, and I thought, okay, I'm going to go straight through the most populated part to the western part where there's more space, and I'll be able to bear that more easily. And really, I was on the way to India because that was sort of my destination. I thought, you know, the end result, I wanted to go walking there. So I went through to Lanzhou and around there. And at that point, I made the decision that instead of feeling under siege like I had done for the last 2 weeks, I'm going to feel like these people are welcoming me. And then that everything changed, and suddenly I felt welcomed. It was just this sort of cognitive shift that was required in my head to actually be open to it. And I went to Xinjiang and traveled around there for 5 or 6 weeks, and had some amazing experiences with both the police harassing me and people like retired army generals adopting me and taking me to places I couldn't otherwise easily get. The very extreme sort of feeling. I also took photographs that I was really stimulated by that environment. So I was photographing, and took photographs, which I still like. I left tired and not planning to go back, but within 3 years I was longing to go back. So I went back, and that's where I started to think about the Han people living in Xinjiang and thinking these are people, these are not like the Han people in the East. Even though I had very little experience with the Han people in the East, I had a feeling they're not the same. And this was sort of prompted, I guess, by my own experience of being a settler, you know, being born in Australia, but coming back to Australia when I was 6 years old and going to live in a place which I was unfamiliar with. And so I felt like there was a sort of a similarity between me and them.
Mm. Where had you come back from at that young age then?
I went back to England when I was 2.5.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and so I started to think about the Han in Xinjiang, and I realized that what I was reading in the academic literature was always focusing on the Uyghurs, at least contemporary. There's some very good stuff done historically. But then I went there, decided to go there and continue to take photographs in 2001. That was my objective. I'm going to go there, get a job, take photographs, and learn the language, because I didn't want to take photographs without understanding something about the place. And I thought the language was important in order to do that. So that's where it sort of started, basically. That's where I posed that question that you posed in the introduction there.
I see. And then how did that then mesh with your subsequent academic pursuits, and how did you bring that into a kind of university context?
Well, then I went to Beijing and worked for CCTV for a while, but at the same time I was applying for a master's. I came back here, did a master's, not intending to be an academic, and then did a PhD, started the PhD, not intending to be an academic. And so I started writing my PhD and researching and thinking about my PhD dissertation with the idea that I want to communicate that China is not, as I'd imagined it before I got there, rice paddies and big, large-brimmed straw hats with people who are really different and don't welcome people. So I wrote it as a book for everybody to be able to read.
That kind of unwelcoming, I suppose, vibe that you got from China as a kind of the image that you'd received earlier in your life. What, do you think that's a widespread view in Australia, is that how you see the kind of Western view of China stereotypically?
I have no idea, really. I certainly didn't get it from my parents. I mean, my parents are well traveled and. It's sort of, I don't really know where that came from. And I'd been traveling around Southeast Asia and I was felt very at home in the Philippines, Indonesia, etc. So I really don't know where that came from. I think part of it was the language. I couldn't, the language was so alien and the script was so alien. So I take in a lot of things through my eyes. I learn a lot of things through my eyes. And so, walking around a place, a streetscape or any sort of scape, that where the language I can't sound out, I can't look at it and sound it out, was quite alienating.
Well,
that's also the attraction.
Sure, of course, yeah, and it sounds like you, I guess, confronted that issue in yourself head on by engaging in it in a more deep way by taking it up in your academic studies. And then how did that proceed through your PhD and ultimately lead you to writing this book, Oil and Water?
Well, my supervisor is quite a hands-off man, Andrew Kipnis. He didn't push me in any way, but one thing he did do in the first months, he made me read a couple of books on colonialism, which I said I wrote very bad reviews of for him. And because I was anti this assumption, you know, making this prior assumption that Xinjiang represents a colonial situation. So he told me to read these two books, or a few books on culture and colonialism. And I read those, and then
which books in particular?
One's called Colonialism's Culture, and the other one is called Colonialism and Culture.
I see, right.
They're both by a person called Nicholas, and they're both by different people called Nicholas. And one's Dirks, D-I-R-K-S, and the other one is Thomas. And I've just forgotten which one's which, because obviously the names of the people are so close and the names of the books are so close. But anyway, Dirks and Thomas, Colonialism's Culture and Colonialism and Culture.
I see.
And they're great books. So then after being in Xinjiang for 14 months, my first field work came back, and I just could not but accept that, in fact, Xinjiang does represent a colonial situation. And so that sort of framed my, not the books, framed my perspective and what I wrote, but in fact, my experience of observing it for 14 months framed it.
I see. And was then the PhD on this subject, and that then built into the book?
That's right, yeah. I basically wrote my PhD to try and make it into a make it as a book. Less of the I am arguing and more of the this is what's going on, this is what I see.
That makes a lot of sense. And that's very interesting to hear how that kind of came up through your academic formation and supervision by Andrew Kipnis too, who was in fact the last person I interviewed for this podcast. So I'd point listeners in the direction of a few podcasts back on the East Asian Studies podcast from the New Books Network to listen to that, which I think is a very good complement to this book too. That's great. Having kind of got a sense of where the book come from, I think we should probably dive right into it and see how this perception that you had of the place as a colonial situation evolved in an intellectual way. Caller, where you spent a lot of your time and the kind of main field site for the project as a whole, sounds like a pretty fascinating and unique kind of a place in this region. Perhaps you could begin by describing what sort of a place it is. You say it's a palimpsest of post-1949 settlements by Han Chinese people. So what are the layers of that palimpsest? What kind of a place is the city, and how is it a good place to look at Han life at Xinjiang and China as a whole?
Okay, yeah. Well, so the first thing, the layers of the palimpsest, there's two main layers, and that is, one is the Xinjiang production and construction core, which is otherwise known as the Bingtuan. And the other, that's the first one. And then the other one is the oil company. So these are the two main era-defining institutions. In between those and overlapping with them, there's also things like the Fourth Transport Company. And all of these state-run, state-managed, state-owned institutions are important for the development of Xinjiang and the way it's been structured. So first, the Bingtuan. Before the Bingtuan got there in 1950, led by Wang Zhen, Kuala was a very small little town. Nothing much there. It had been a way station, like a postal station, because it sits at a particularly sort of what's considered to be a strategic pass, and also at a crossroads where the road diverges. You either go directly south and around the basin, the south basin of Xinjiang, the Tarim Basin, or you go west and then south towards Kashgar around the top. And Kuala sits at that place. And so transport was important. And the Bingtuan was important because they like to occupy these sort of key areas. So he put in a lot of irrigation. Him and his workers put in a lot of irrigation. And that's the first sort of state institution that got there, along with the government. It moved. The government was originally further away. It was up in the Yanchi. Then it moved to where the Kuala is now. Then these transport companies came along and other things, but mainly the transport company was a big one, and that brought a lot. At that time, there was this fantastic, what I consider very fascinating thing, where each key node through Xinjiang had its own transport companies. So if you got goods coming from the inland China to Kashgar, it would have to be transferred. Say, it would go to Turpan, and then it would be loaded off those trucks and onto Tulafan Transport Company trucks, and then down to Kuala, and then onto Caller Transport Company trucks, and then down to, I think it was Aksu or somewhere, and then next and all the way to Kashgar, because this is like a divvying up of the right to make money out of that. So those institutions were important. When that was broken down, when that rule that it has to be carried through your territory by your trucks was stopped, obviously the Fourth Transport Company declined, but by that time it already had lots of trucks and lots of employees. So that was like the second institution. And then the oil company came along, just sort of the demise of the in the late 80s, it rose up. Like by the mid 80s, it sort of began at the demise, at the same time that the Fourth Transport Company demised. So those are the key institutions.
I see. And each brought with it a distinct cohort of Han Chinese settlers from Inner China, as you say, from Neidi. Where were those people coming from, and what were the circumstances under which they arrived in this place?
Well, the distinct cohort for the Bingtuan was the original demobilized soldiers from both the PLA and the GMD, the Kuomintang, who had surrendered, or in fact, they'd surrendered, but they were calling it a mutiny against the GMD. And then they joined the PLA, and then they got sent down to Kola. There was not a lot of the ones in Kola were PLA. There was fewer GMD. GMD, those troops got sent to other places more than Kola, relatively. But they made up the first group, and then afterwards those people were joined by Shanghai sent down youth, and they were also joined by a couple of waves of women who were supposed to marry those people. So this is a very interesting story, and one which is not taken up in my book, but it's certainly one that is worth writing about. These men, there was overall in Xinjiang, there was, let's say, 150,000 men, most of them without wives, most of them well past the normal marriageable age and very keen to get married because, you know, really all they want is to have a settled life. They've been fighting a war for all of their adult lives. And Wang Zhen saw this situation and he said, well, what we need in order to have stability here, we need stability among these Bingtuan people. You know, that's really the key thing. It's more key than stability among the Uyghurs and other types of people. What we need is stability among our people.
And amongst that, those early cohorts of demobilized civil war soldiers, you say that there was some distinction between where former PLA combatants and Kuomintang fighters were sent. Was there remaining sort of distinctions, social distinctions and grievances, I guess, that lasted on from that civil war conflict that persisted even amongst Bingtuan settlers, or was that all sort of forgotten quite quickly? What's your impression of the, you know, the cleavage that really, you know, split China in two for decades? How did that persist beyond the 50s?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. There's certainly been somebody, Amy Cardos, who's argued that that's a very distinct thing, and that the GMD soldiers were discriminated against. And I've spoken with people who've said that, but I also know plenty of people who were the descendants or are the descendants of GMD soldiers, and they're very well off. Colleagues of mine in the oil company were like that. So I don't think it's uniform. You can't make an argument that says, oh, yes, the GMD were always discriminated against. No, they were not. It's very contextual and place specific. If there was stress in the environment, I'm just speculating here, if there was a lot of stress in the environment, there wasn't enough to go around, or if they needed internal enemies for some reason, then the GMD people would probably be more up for that than the PLA people.
I see. Yeah, I was surprised. I studied in Urumqi for a while, and one of my teachers was a Kuomintang descendants, very happy to talk about that fact. It seemed very striking, having spent some time in a China where that didn't seem to feature quite so much, that was a feature of Xinjiang life. So that's interesting to hear about. And then that later period of settlement with the oil company and so on, was that what kind of people were brought in at that time? How did they differ from, say, the early demobilized soldiers and then the sent down youth?
Yeah, the sent down youth. I should add, there's another thing in there, is the Third Front factories. So they were totally relocated from China on block. But yeah, let's get to the oil company. The oil company people, they were taken from the oil companies in Xinjiang already. So there was two at that time. There was one near Hami, and then when there was the main one where the headquarters was based up in Karamai. And so people would volunteer. Basically, they'd say, okay, yes, we'll be willing to go down to Tarim, where the conditions were pretty harsh down in Tarim at that time. And so it wasn't a favored posting. And there was also people in Daqing. Daqing at that time was reaching a production decline, it already reached a production decline. It was overpopulated. So they sent people from Shengli, which is in Shandong, and they sent people from Daqing, and people could volunteer to go there, or just sort of, you have to do a rotation, 3 years. And then if you like it enough, can bear it enough, then you can choose to stay there. They were quite desperate for people. But by the time the mid-late 80s came along, they were producing quite well, and all the other oil companies, the local oil companies, were in decline, more or less. So Tarim became more and more attractive. So there was people who saw the writing on the wall more quickly and volunteered to go to Tarim. And as it was, you know, that was a good decision.
No, that makes sense. Actually, that brings up an issue which I think is one very widely discussed, but perhaps not always particularly well understood, with regard to Han settlements in Xinjiang, over voluntarism versus coercion or incentivization from the center. Is it the case that the picture has changed over time in terms of the proportion of people being strongly encouraged / forced to resettle, or is it always the case that there's been a mix of both voluntary and sort of persuaded migrants? Certainly in Western media portrayals, the idea that Chinese people, Han Chinese people, have been put in Xinjiang is the picture that is often painted. But could you say something about how that picture unfolds, both over time and at any given moment?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really interesting question. And there's always been some voluntary, although in the early 1950s, that there was probably not very much of that. But by the time the Great Leap Famine was hitting, in places like Gansu, there was lots of people thinking, where can I go? I can go to Xinjiang. So there's a story in my book about one lady who was born, and she's a girl, obviously, and her father was so upset that he chucked her out the door in the middle of winter, and she got picked up by the neighbors. And then she got raised as an adopted child and married in an arranged marriage to a man who'd already had a wife, and she died, and then he was old and abusive, and then she gave birth to three children, and then she ran away in the middle of the famine. Just after the old man died, he was too weak to survive the famine. So she ran away to Xinjiang, arranged by her some relative, like her sister was married to, or maybe her brother knew a comrade in Xinjiang who was a GMD soldier. And so then they said, okay, come to Xinjiang and be one of the wives we need in order to secure this place. And so she went to Xinjiang in 1960 or 61. So that's one element of the voluntary. It's pushed in some way because it's, you know, she's running away, she has to survive. But at the same time, it's a voluntary thing. The state wasn't saying, come out here, we'll give you this, this, this. Although they were doing that at the same time. They were doing that before and after that because they still needed women. And then in more recent times, especially after reform and opening up, you know, there was a lot of the go west, young Han or type thing. And even Wang and Mao made a plea to people. You know, this is where Xinjiang is a place where, you know, people who are involved in constructing can make the best of themselves. He said, you know, you that's where. It's, so it's really the rhetoric and the sort of advertising was very similar to that of the sort of American West. The idea that the frontier is a place where you can find. You can make a go of it, also be liberated in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Some people chose to go to Xinjiang. Like, say, for example, sorry for butting in there. There was one instance of a man who was a Korean War vet, and in the late 1950s, he had a chance to go to various different places. He could have gone to some good, solid old oil fields. He was told to go into the oil company, and because he was a ranking officer, he could have gone to Shengli or somewhere else. But because his family and he, if he'd gone to Shengli, he would have had a decent wage and pension, etc. But he was too close; would have been too close to his family, and then his family would want stuff off him. So he decided to go as far as he could, all the way out to Xinjiang, so his family wouldn't come asking him for material goods. And he came out. He went out to Karamai.
That's really interesting. And I guess the kind of broad contours of the picture then is that there's a pretty sliding spectrum between, say, coercion and voluntarism. And I guess these are issues that will come up later in the book, when we talk about some of the structures and the ideas of agency and quite how it is that the settlers have forged lives there. But you mentioned the American West there, and that's a pretty good transition on to the kind of conceptual frame within which you propose we can understand this overall situation in terms of ideas like colonization and empire and indeed the frontier. So could you perhaps now say a little more about how it was that your initial impressions of the place as a colony, as an imperial kind of situation emerge in the book itself, and how you kind of pin these conceptual anchors into your material.
Right. So in the book, I have three core themes. Organizing principles in my mind, in a sense, because the book is like a series of vertical orientations. The core chapters of the book are vertically oriented life stories, but within any life story, these cross-cutting thematic elements which are similar or resonate with one another. So it's like a weave and weft, warp and weft on in weaving. They're vertically oriented and horizontally. The horizontally oriented things are these themes. So migration relates to how people got to where they are. That's not just physically. That's also, you know, their growth of social status. Empire relates to the relationship between the core and the periphery. And time, how do I summarize that? Time relates to,
I mean, the sense of settler time, or the sense of how it is perceived that the frontier is perhaps somewhere that is both in advance of and also hanging back from the center. Are these sort of ideas central to your understanding of
that's time? Right. Sorry. Yeah. Thank you for filling in there. That's the behind and ahead thing. Yeah, when I was walking around, I spent a lot of time walking around and cycling around and photographing. And so when I was seeing Xinjiang and talking about that place with people, and they're talking about that or just offering their opinion on things, the overriding state and popular discourse is that Xinjiang is behind. But at the same time, there was all this sort of experimentation going on. And, of course, I'd read James Millwood's book where he talks about this, and I'd been interested in frontiers, and I read some literature on frontiers. And the key thing that I took from that is that the frontier is a place of experimentation. It's a laboratory. It's a laboratory for institutions and policies, but it's also a laboratory for people, sort of in the Russian Central Asian context, for people to work out who they are. And so this was interesting to me because Lin Zexu, let's take an example of from Chinese history, where Lin Zexu, who was the commissioner in the Opium War, got sent out to Xinjiang after the first Opium War began, after it ended, because he had not handled the British correctly, according to the Qing center. So he sent out there as exile, right? So that brings up another thing about the frontier, which is both exile and liberation. He went out there, like so many poets and other people before and after him, who were exiled but not criminals, sent out there, and they have sort of revelations. So to come back to this place, to this idea of the frontier as a place of innovation, and I saw these innovative things, and one of the innovative things I saw, because I was in the center of it working as a teacher at the oil company, was the oil company, and which the way in which they construct that institution, the way that they actually are able to make new institutions, whereas in the center, in the core area, it might not have been possible to make a new institution like that. Maybe politically it might not have been possible, or socio-politically. It certainly wouldn't have been easy because there wasn't any new oil fields, whereas in Xinjiang you have a blank slate. You know, this idea of a blank slate, and regardless of whether it is actually a blank slate, the fact that it's seen as a blank slate enables these new things to come up.
And that particular example draws attention to, I suppose, one question that might arise when we're comparing broad, I guess, abstracted frontier or imperial scenarios, namely that around whether there's a significant difference between the frontier of a centralized state socialist country like the People's Republic of China, or indeed the Soviet Union, as you mentioned, trying to reforge humanity in a sort of Promethean top-down kind of a way, and that of a your archetypal American or indeed perhaps Australian frontier, coming from a at least a non 20th century socialist situation. Do you see key differences there in terms of the kind of innovations that are possible, or the way that the frontier takes shape when the center is a socialist, top-down sort of a center in this way?
There are differences, but I think my first point would be that the similarities are more than the differences. So there's more similarities. Now, what are the differences and why do they come up? The differences would be that in the case of China versus the Australia-Britain relationship, these are the two things which I'm most familiar with. Or the Britain, wherever, the Dutch East Indies and the Dutch. That sort of classic European imperialism, and then now Australia, Britain, and then the history of China and its relationship with Xinjiang. And the switch is that China, in the early 20th century, made this switch from being self-identified as an empire to being self-identified as a nation state. And so the key thing about that is that empires can tolerate to some degree, to a much larger degree, this thinning of their cultural authority and cultural consistency towards the edge of the empire. By definition, an empire includes all these people who are different. And so it's okay to have, you know, like almost a blurred boundary. Some empires were like that. They didn't actually have a boundary. You know, it's really indistinct where the boundary is. Whereas a nation state is a very clear boundary, right down to the centimeter almost. And the culture, not just the political authority, but the culture somehow is supposed to go up to that boundary. And then it makes a very distinct switch into the next boundary. Now, that's obviously not true, but that's how it's sort of desired and seen. So that's the distinction. But China is still, in many ways, an empire because it includes all these different people, but it wants to be a nation state. It wants to make things more homogenous and more normal in its core terms.
Right, and this is precisely the next subject I was going to move on to, which is this idea of normalization, which you bring out a kind of key conceit in the book, and a way of discussing the processes ongoing in Kuala and Xinjiang as a whole. What is this idea of normalization? Where does it come from, and how does it manifest itself in today's Xinjiang?
In today's Xinjiang, it's horrendous. It's unforgiving, extreme normalization. Because now in today's Xinjiang, there are these, they're called transformation education centers. And sometimes they even have concentration on the front of that. In the Chinese, concentration transformation education centers or education transformation centers. But basically, they're concentration camps for re-education and recalibration of Islamic people, Uyghurs primarily, to Han norms and ways of life. And so this is the extreme intolerance. These things represent the high level, a high point probably in history of the intolerance of the core of their periphery. So that's what's going on at the moment. Now, my idea about normalization is that normalization aims to make Xinjiang and people in Xinjiang more like Neidi, the core area, and people in the core area. And what I brought to that was that it's not just about making Uyghurs in that way. It's about making Han in that way. Obviously, Uyghurs and Han are treated differently in this normalization. But Han are also subjects of normalization in my view, and that's what I've seen. They are also seen as not people of the core. They're from the core, and they actually don't see themselves as people of the core. Most Han in Xinjiang, who are the subjects by definition who I'm talking to and about, are Han Xinjiang people, Xinjiang Han. They call themselves Xinjiang people. And so there's this distinction between what Han in Xinjiang call themselves. We are Xinjiang people, Xinjiang Ren. And when people in the core area of China and the predominantly Han areas, culturally Han areas of China, when they talk about Xinjiang Ren, they talk about Xinjiang people, they mean Uyghurs generally. When a Xinjiang Han goes to the core area of China since 2009, anyway, at least, they'll have a problem. That even if they're a Han person, it's on their identity card. Checking into a hotel can sometimes be difficult. It's not only Uyghurs who are discriminated against in that way.
That's very interesting, and I think something that is palpably present across China, as you mentioned. I mean, you explain very clearly that the Uyghurs are a central part of your ethnography of Han life in China. And I think you've just brought out, Han life in Xinjiang. And you've just brought out some of the complex interplays that exist there. But obviously what is striking too is that, and I think this emerges as much as anything in our conversation so far, which has only now got onto the theme of the other around half of the population of Xinjiang, is that these worlds can exist in pretty separate ways, and the extent of contact with your between your interlocutors in Kuala and the Uyghurs in southern Xinjiang at large was extremely low by the sounds of by the picture that you paint in the book. So perhaps we could just move on, and we've discussed a lot of, I think, the key issues already, but we could move on perhaps to talking about some of the chapters in particular, and especially, again, a point you've hinted at already, this idea of construction and who the constructors are and how the Han are encouraged to be, to embody this constructor role and play a part in making civilization on the frontier. Who are the constructors, and how does looking at them in this way, how does taking the portrayal of constructors by the center seriously help us understand their place and some of the situations in Han society in Kuala?
Well, ultimately, this idea of constructor is something that, you know, if you're a constructor, you are putting your full energies into constructing Xinjiang. And that means, you know, changing, culturally changing Xinjiang and building stuff, building physical things, but also building a consistency, building a new culture there. And it's like so many things in Chinese political discourse and life, that you have to put your whole heart into it. And your heart in China, of course, means your mind. In Western psychology and philosophy, we think about the mind as driving things, and the Chinese think about the heart. So when you're putting your heart into it, that means you're putting your full mental, emotional, and physical self. And so you can't just go there and build stuff and get your wage, because it's not about just building stuff. You have to be, you know, fully committed to this great project of nation building. That's what a constructor is in the state description and in the description of people who take on the state and embody that, and then try to impress that and on other people, and use that to make distinctions between the Han who are constructors and the people who are not constructors, because they're just there to make money, for example. And then they might go back to their home in Eastern China or Central China. Mm. So that's the sort of definition. Now, along with that is explicitly or implicitly, and often explicitly, a notion of sacrifice. When you're putting yourself into everything, it doesn't matter if you're not getting, because you're so committed to it, it doesn't matter if you're not getting back what you expect, you know, because you're expected to be committed to the project. And that's been the Bing Tuan experience, because these people, you know, there were soldiers that were under command, and then they were demobilized, but they were still under command because it was a military government. And then they were still under command even when the military government finished, because they were in a Bing Tuan, which is a quasi-military organization, for its first part of its life. And so sacrifice is expected of these constructors. And it's very useful, of course, for the state to have people who are expected to be sacrificing for the state. So it's a useful one it continues. It's also useful for institutions. If institutions say, look, we are constructors, then we can claim rewards on the basis of that. The Bing Tuan's a classic. They're always saying, you know, we're the constructors, and therefore we should be treated well. And this even came up after 2009 among individuals, and collectively Han people in Xinjiang. They're saying, you know, collectively the Han mainstream, so the ordinary Han people who are not necessarily the political elite, they're certainly not the sojourning migrant workers, they have sacrificed. They're out there on the frontier sacrificing themselves by living there, by reproducing there. You know, it's very important that Han people are settled there and reproducing there. That is what is the basis of the claim, the central claim to Xinjiang. If they just had military there or people just sojourning, doing work, their claim is weakened greatly, almost almost fatally. Mm. But if there's people there reproducing and saying, yeah, we are the heart of Xinjiang. Xinjiang is our place. We are Xinjiang people. That is the most solid claim that the core political core of China can make to Xinjiang. Mm. So after 2009, that's what they're leveraging. That's what the people in Xinjiang, the Han people in Xinjiang, are leveraging to say to the central government, look, get it together. We here have been sacrificing ourselves for 60 years and suffering, and you've reduced our bursaries and extra things that used to be because we were on the, you know, like these hardship posting bonuses. And so now it's time to re-up those things, you know, take some notice of us. Otherwise, it's going to descend into chaos.
No, that's really seems a key dimension of the larger scale processes unfolding there. And you elaborate more in the book, and I should point listeners in that direction. That you have some really rich sort of ethnographic and narrative observations of how some of the distinctions are made and maintained and argued about, debated over among different cohorts of Han arrivals, sojourning workers, longer term residents, and so on. So that comes through in particularly rich fashion in this early chapter. Perhaps we can move on to one of the era defining institutions you mentioned. We've already talked a bit about the Binduan in the introduction, but perhaps you can now say more about the oil company, which obviously was where you were sort of lodged as a teacher, and where, I guess, it's an institution which many of your interlocutors had a direct connection to. How does looking at Tajiru, the Tarim oilfield company in Kuala, help us understand some of these processes of construction, and particularly broader pictures of the frontier? You say some very interesting things about how the institution itself is both an innovator and a socialist remnant, a sort of a neo-Damway, you put it. Could you describe a bit more about the company and its role in embodying this kind of frontier ethos?
Okay, I'll start with the specific question about the innovator and the neo-Danway. So the corporate structure of Tarja is different to all of the other companies, oil companies in China. It has a much lower permanent workforce to whom it is committed with, to provide salaries and things for. So they have only 10,000 permanent workforce. And then they have all these other contract and non-permanent employees. And although they still, an interesting resonance here, just as an aside, is that they still do provide employment for their workers' wives, because most of their workers are men, because they're technical staff and men tend to study technical stuff more.
And almost all of their workers are Han, is that correct?
Yes. The exception to that is that the oil company land was previously mostly occupied by Uyghurs on the non-Bingtuan side of Kuala City. So it was a county. And the Bingtuan was on one side of the river, and the fourth transport company is on that side of the river as well. And the center of the town is on that side. But then this new place, Kuala, offered that to the oil company and outbid Aksu for that, for the right to have that oil company there. And then they said, okay, so you can have this plot of land. And when the oil company wanted to expand, there was another bit of land, which there was also Uyghur farmers on. And they said to those Uyghur farmers, okay, you can have some money in compensation, and one of your children can have a job in the oil company. By that time, the oil company was a good place to work, so that was a good deal. And so those are the sort of very few Uyghur employees of the oil company. Otherwise, they're all directly taken from the top oil company training institutions in central eastern China. Mm. Yeah, so the innovation, the key innovation is the company structure, the low amount of staff, and using technical, like using technology to reduce the staff burden. And because they have that low amount of staff, and they have gas is quite profitable, although it's debatable whether their petroleum, their oil extraction is profitable. I've heard a couple of different stories. Some people say, yes, we're making money out of that. And some people say, no, we're not making money out of that. It's way too far down. It's very difficult geographical formations underneath the middle of the desert where they get it out from. And so they're not making money on that. Either way, they're definitely profitable overall, and they pass that on to their workers in those classic sort of innovative ways. Like they're only allowed to pay them a certain amount for a pension according to the local rules, but they do other things by they get a sort of in-house pension system to get around the rules. So that's sort of some the innovations. Now the persistence is these things like they will give workers' wives jobs, you know, because they still need the workers to be there and they're men, like I say. And so when a man gets married, his wife, whoever he marries, will get a job in the oil company. And that will be, if she's skilled, she'll get a job appropriate to that skill level. But it's likely she's not skilled. She might have been a waitress beforehand. In fact, in one interesting little aside, there's a sort of minor industry in organizing jobs for eligible, relatively attractive women to be waitresses in places where oil company, like in oil company hotels, to meet the young men who have just come in from their study and have just been employed by the oil company. And can then matchmake, you know, because they see these girls every day, they're serving them, and then they get married, and the girl has a life in the oil company. So that's one way, it's a neo-down way. But also, the very, you know, Andrew Walder's structure of hierarchy. So you have to have those connections, you have to be inside the oil company, you have to be a full worker in order to get the benefits. And so it in some way resonates with Andrew Walder's description of the neo-traditionalism.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating to hear that kind of rich and nuanced picture drawn out through the life stories that you recount in your in the book. The way that Danway and sort of socialist logics coexist with some of these innovative things, and I think it brings out in very compelling ways the frontier operation of a lot of this stuff, as well as, we should say, the highly gendered way that things continue to operate in the company, which, given what we know of historic frontiers elsewhere, is a feature of many of those too, the very masculinist ethos that drives the idea of pushing out and forging a new path, and then sort of the idea that women come behind to sort of support things once as things are getting established. And we perhaps don't have time to get into real depth on these subjects now, but chapters 5 and 6 of the book discuss a little more the relationships, the guanxi that operate within the company and outside the company, and help us to understand some of the distinctions between variant generations and professions among Han settlers, and also variant relationships with the center and how they play a role in marriage choices and people wanting to marry people with stronger company and social safety net connections. All of that is described in very rich detail in chapters 5 and 6, but I'll point listeners in that direction perhaps to look into it for themselves, because we perhaps don't have time to go into it fully here. However, having discussed a little more this kind of broad frontier picture and a theme running throughout our conversation today, perhaps we could just move on to the very final part of the book, the last chapter, 7, the partnership of stability in Xinjiang, and your conclusion concerning what it is that I suppose the most compelling question here is what it is that the Chinese state is trying to do in Xinjiang. We've talked already today about normalization, about the process of settlement and forging a constructor ethos and attempting to make an empire into a nation state, if you like. But you have some pretty interesting things to say about the actual project of the Chinese state in Xinjiang and what it is that the center is trying to achieve there. Could you perhaps go into this a little more?
Okay, so I mean, basically, I've been asking myself this question, what is the Chinese state trying to achieve there? And they're always talking about, you know, integration. And I think I changed that word integration into normalization, as we've discussed before, to make Xinjiang more like the core area. And so the paradox or the contradiction of this whole project, which I bring up from beginning to end, is that first of all, you have a situation where it's the state is trying to make a cultural periphery more like the cultural core. And it is about culture, as we flagged at the beginning. It's not about their political power or economy or anything like that.
So by culture, we're referring to religion, to Islam, to everyday practices. What is it that exactly you're gesturing at there with that broad term culture?
All of those things. Islam not necessarily being the most important, I wouldn't say. I think it's more like everyday practices and assumptions. And particularly it's come out since I published the book, and it's become increasingly clear to me that it's about structures, assumptions of the hierarchy or systems of cultural authority. And so who pays tribute to whom? And I'm starting to see it in family terms, to be honest. It's now, instead of the Uyghurs can be their own family, you know, so we're an empire, and there's the Han family, and then there's all these other different families, and the Uyghurs are one of them. Now Uyghurs cannot be a different family. They have to be part of the Chinese family. And the Chinese family in this case increasingly means the Han family. So that's the really, really unforgiving normalization that I'm talking about. They instead of the Uyghurs having their own patriarchal structures and with God the ultimate at the apex, now they must have the current Han patriarchal structures with the party and Xi Jinping at the apex. Because lineages in China structures of authority in China have always gone through, in many cases, gone through lineages at the grassroots up to the emperor or the head of state at the apex. And ancestor worship is incorporated into that. It's one whole thing, even if it's very diverse. But Uyghurs always ended in God. Now God is the Communist Party. I've been in China so many times recently where people are not talking about believing in the party. Believing the party, right? So they're saying that we can trust the party, we believe the party. They're talking about believing in the party. Yeah, and so the party has sort of become God, and that's what is trying, you know, they're trying to do in Xinjiang is make Uyghurs God the party instead of Allah. That's how I see it. And that goes through the family. It's the family is essential in that. So the urbanization of Kuala, for example, and the breaking down of these Uyghur ways of living in space, where you got extended households in adobe dwellings, and doing agriculture, small-scale agriculture, doing small-scale trading, etc., and then putting them in all apartment buildings. That's the first step to break down those family structures, those family social and economic structures. And the concentration camps that we're talking about is a more direct, muscular way of doing that, same with going towards the same end. Now, there's another thing which is related to your question, which is about integration and the whole process of normalization. And that is that because the culture is always going to be different, there's always this churning of culture on the frontier, the full integration of the frontier is impossible. It can never be. It's a destination which can never be reached. And then in the conclusion, in the last pages, actually, I make the point that that is not only impossible, it's also undesirable from the cause point of view. Even though they're constantly saying we want to, you know, develop Xinjiang, culturally develop Xinjiang, which means making it more normal, and economically develop it, etc., integrate Xinjiang in the classic political science way, they can't, and it wouldn't be good for the core because the core is always wants to be a core. And in order for it to be a core and for it to be the center of light and the high point in the nation state or empire of culture, it has to have a lower point. It has to be somewhere that's lower. And so the core and the periphery always exist in relation to one another. If you don't have a periphery that's lower, you can't have a core that's higher. And so it's undesirable for the core, even though the core is constantly pushing towards this integration. So this is constant tension and paradox.
Well, I think you make that point very persuasively throughout the whole book. Obviously, we could go on talking about it for a lot longer because the implications of it are profound, wide-ranging, and one has to say pretty harrowing for the future of this place. But I think, unfortunately, we may have to draw it to a close here. We've already taken up a fair bit of your time. So before we go, perhaps I could just ask you our traditional question. What is it that you're working on now? How have you moved on from your work in Xinjiang and what sort of projects have you got on the go at present?
Well, for 5 years or so, I've had one on petitioners, old lady petitioners, and this is related to those old women who moved out to Xinjiang, who were wives. And I'm studying the same sort of people both in Xinjiang and in the Northeast. And I'm hoping to look at the similar people in other places around China, like Inner Mongolia. But this is a long-term social history type project that I'm trying to do before, to be honest, all these people pass away. And so that's one long-term one. My main current one is on non-state welfare. And so it's about entrepreneurs, factory-owning entrepreneurs who have only small family businesses in rural China, in the east side of rural China, setting up either lineage-based or village-based welfare funds to serve the old people or the students. So it's about education and filial piety, both which are long-term concerns of lineage organizations through history. But this is a new form because I'm studying this from the perspective of social control and how these things are being encouraged and then innovating themselves. So they're giving space to innovate and then innovating in different forms, slightly different forms, and then being shaped by state actions. So I'm studying the negotiation of that shaping and how those organizations are either presenting a different power structure, creating different power structures at the grassroots in China, or being melded successfully by state operators into new ways of exerting power at the grassroots, state power at the grassroots in rural China.
Well, that sounds fascinating. It sounds like a lot of cognate and related themes from your previous work will emerge there too. And I think we'll look forward to reading some of the results of that, as it will, I think, complement greatly the insight into the system as a whole and indeed some of the more grassroots and the ways it operates on the ground. So that's great. Thanks for telling us about that. And thank you very much for appearing today. It was brilliant talking to you, and the book is fantastic. Thanks a lot, Tom.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Ed.
And listeners, thank you very much, as always, for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. I would urge you to go out and get a copy of this book. We haven't been able to cover everything in it today, but it deals with a subject which I don't think other interviewees will mind my saying is of a real urgency and vital that we understand as much about this as possible and try and adapt our thinking about the situation accordingly. So yes, thank you for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network, and I will speak to you next time.